Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about networking, we started by talking about, a very important practical issue for networking, which is that, we talked about routers and, your machine has an address and we use that address to get to your machine. Well, it turns out we kind of don't have enough IPv4 addresses. So what we do instead is we have kind of this router take the place of all the machines on the private network, but make it appear to the private network that those machines are actually kind of connected directly to the internet. So based on the first quiz question, I should go over this more, though we'll talk a bit about the first quiz question. So the illusion the network address translation gives you is that your private IP address on this private network, where the IP addresses aren't real internet IP addresses, it looks like you're talking directly to that machine on the other network. So you use your private local address, you use the public remote address, and in the normal operation, you never see the router's address. Part of making this work is that, when you connect to a remote machine, your machine expects to see a response from that remote machine. You connected with its IP address. That response needs to have the IP address it came from in it. But to the outside, we can't reveal any of the private IP addresses, so those are replaced with the router's IP. And on the quiz, I sort of made a mistake because we're kind of shifting this semester to covering networking at a higher level. I didn't think carefully about what do we actually know about destination IP addresses. But part of the layering model that made the answer that most people chose not technically correct, but I gave credit because we didn't discuss it, is that when we're sending IP addresses, those are always going to be the IP address that it came from across all networks, or it's going to across all networks, ignoring things like network address translation. So the IP address doesn't change when we go through a router, generally. Network address translation is an exception because we're hiding the private addresses. But when we aren't hiding addresses, we don't change them as we go through a router. You might say, but wait a moment. When I'm sending from the router to a particular machine, don't I need to put the right, sorry, when I send from a particular machine to the router to get to the internet, don't I need to put the address of the router somewhere? And the answer is yes. But we don't use IP addresses for that. We use addresses that are specific to the link layer, which are a different type of addresses. Since we didn't discuss that, I give credit for all the answers that let us still figure out where the packet came from on the quiz question, but I should have just not asked about the source address on the question, given what we covered. But we have to have it the same, and one big reason why it has to be the same is, remember we talked about how sockets work. When the final machine receives the packet, it needs to send it to the right socket, and it knows what socket it is based on what address it connected to. So it has to match the address we connected to. So that's about that. So we have to talk about sort of that we have to get our initial IP addresses, and we mentioned the API for the lab you'll do tomorrow. Then we started talking about what will be our topic for today, which is about sort of security, and in particular, tools for providing two security properties, kind of using some mathematics. And the properties were confidentiality and authenticity. So confidentiality means we keep something secret from people who aren't supposed to know it. Authenticity means we verify that something came from a particular principal and that it wasn't manipulated. And we talked about tools for doing this where we share some secret information between the people who are communicating in advance. And we do that securely somehow, and then we use that to bootstrap confidentiality and authenticity. And we got confidentiality with this tool we called symmetric encryption, or we just called it encryption, but we now have a new type, so we're going to distinguish the two with symmetric encryption. And we provided authenticity with message authentication, or I should write codes. That's part of the name. which I will most of the time abbreviate as MAC in all caps. And we learned that our symmetric encryption, even though we could combine these two things to provide both at the same time, often when someone gives you an encryption function, it doesn't provide the authenticity part, it just provides the confidentiality part, and this means that often it's actually practical for an attacker to manipulate these encrypted messages. And that was the other thing people had trouble with on the quiz. Then on the quiz, we had this scenario where we were sending messages back and forth, and we did something that seems like kind of obviously stupid, of not just encrypting and applying a message authentication code to absolutely everything. Surely that's what we should do. Indeed, it probably is what we should do. But since we didn't do that, are things that were just encrypted, if we don't know that we're using an encryption algorithm that already includes authentication codes, which is not going to be the default when you like look up a library for this, then an attacker can manipulate those messages, and they can do so very selectively in many cases, if they can guess what the prior message was. So then we went on to a problem that we're going to continue to address today of, sharing secret keys is kind of hard. So we're going to have some mathematical tools that make it easier for us to share keys. And the primary way they're going to do this is that instead of having these shared secrets, we're going to have public-private key pairs. And we can just give the public key pair to everyone. So no longer do we need to keep the key that we're giving other people secret. We can tell everyone about it. We just need to make sure it's not manipulated. And we have this private key that we just never, ever share, ever. And we had our first scheme that used these private key pairs, which was asymmetric encryption. So with asymmetric encryption, you can do the operation everyone's allowed to do, which is encrypting with the public key. And you can do the operation that only some people should be allowed to do, which is decrypting with the private key. Some questions about these things we covered last time or other things about the quiz? So I know there were some other questions about that in the other section. Okay, so we're going to pick up with asymmetric encryption. So we have these two functions, and it looks very much like our encryption function, except encrypt and decrypt, except now I've just renamed the function slightly, and we have a public and a private key. Yeah. And we follow this rule that the private key never share with anyone, even the people we're communicating with. We don't share it with them. They only need the public key. Public key lets them send messages to us, and we're going to have to use some other way of verifying the messages come from the right place. We could use a message authentication code. We're going to talk next about a different way of doing that. And so we have our asymmetric encryption, where we have sort of a separate key pair for each recipient. We send the public key to everyone. And with the encryption function, the kind of the mathematically magical thing here is that the encryption function is one way if you only have the public key, but it's reversible if you have the private key. And that's something we're going to rely on people doing some math wizardry when we can look up examples of that, or we can talk about it offline. But there's going to be some mathematical way of providing that. And we aren't making it like impossible to decrypt, mathematically impossible to decrypt. We're making it impractical, meaning that your algorithms, people will say, well, that takes infinite time effectively. But there's going to be a mathematical way of decrypting. It's just not going to be something that you'll ever have time in this universe to do, hopefully, assuming we built the function correctly, which is maybe uncertain. And this is compared to symmetric encryption, where because there's only one key, if you can encrypt, you can decrypt, and vice versa. So our common use of this is that it's going to look very similar to when we used symmetric encryption. That when you want to send something, We're going to pass it through our encrypt function using a public key we got somehow in advance. And we're going to get some data. I'm representing this as stars, but it's really going to be some binary data. And we're going to send that over the network. When B receives it, this is B's encrypted with B's public key, so B can use their private key to decrypt it and get the original thing that A passed. So questions about asymmetric encryption? So we're going to move talk about, we have asymmetric encryption. We have this tool that I briefly talked about last time that we're going to talk about. Or is that we have digital signatures. And digital signatures are basically the asymmetric version of message authentication codes. So with message authentication codes, we can generate something to allow us to let someone to later verify a message actually came from someone. And that's what we're going to get provided with digital signatures. So we have to split the key into sort of a private key operation and a public key operation. We're going to make it so we use the private key first, unlike asymmetric encryption. We use the public key first, and then we decrypt with the private key. Here we're going to use the private key to do this thing we'll call signing. And that will generate a signature. And this signature is kind of like our message authentication code tag. But we can't do the thing we did with the message authentication code, where, well, what we did to verify in that case is we reproduced the tag and checked that it matched. The problem here is that if anyone can reproduce the tag, you know, it wouldn't really work out. So our signature is not going to be something anyone can produce. But that means that we can't just verify it by producing a new one and checking that it matches. So instead, the person who provides us our mathematical tools here is going to provide us, in addition to our sign function that acts like the MAC function, a verify function that checks a signature. And the verify function only needs the public key and the message and the signature. It doesn't use the private key, which is good because it means someone can verify signatures but can't make new ones that are valid. And a verify function, when the signature matches, will give us a 1. If it doesn't match, it will give us a 0. And if this function is constructed correctly, it will be very hard for an attacker, even an attacker who knows the public key and a whole bunch of signatures and a whole bunch of corresponding messages and the function B and the function S, to figure out new messages and their signatures. You know, they won't be able to generate new messages because they don't have the private key. They can't reproduce what the sign function does in practical time. So questions about our digital signature operation, our sign and verify here, before we actually start talking about using them in some non-trivial ways. So our typical use, it's going to look very much like what we did with message authentication codes. That we're going to, when we generate a message, we're going to sign it with our private key, and we're going to send the message and the thing we signed together, and then we're going to have B is going to have to verify that using the verify function, because they can't generate a new signature like we do for Macs, and make sure that it wasn't tampered with. And if our attacker edits part of this message, that's going to make this verify function return a 0. Actually, 0 instead, because the message was tampered with. And the attacker's not going to have any way of editing the corresponding signature, because it's constructed in such a way where that's going to be very hard, given what the formulas are. So, I mentioned when I talked about our quiz, it seems silly that why weren't we signing and verifying everything? Surely that's what we should be doing. And now we have these building blocks. You know, if we want to use public keys or if we want to use shared secrets, you know, that provide us confidentiality and authenticity. So you might say, well, okay, let's just use them. But It turns out that a big practical concern is that you can have secure versions of these building blocks for confidentiality and authenticity and use them in a way where you don't get those properties. This is a very common thing to happen, and we're going to go through kind of the most common ways of doing this. If you actually want to, like, prove your system doesn't have it, there are some sort of formal mathematical kind of proof-based systems for doing that. But we're going to talk kind of more informally about kind of what kinds of problems you're likely to run into. And part of the reason I'm talking about these is that often people, like, when they're looking at, I'm using encryption, therefore things are secure, or if they're thinking about maybe my encryption isn't secure, their first thought is maybe I'm using the wrong encryption algorithm. But most commonly, we have these other types of problems where the building blocks are fine. We're using the encryption algorithm we're using wasn't a bad choice, even though, yes, you can make bad choices. But we're using them in a way that doesn't actually give us the properties we want. And as an example, we're going to talk about authenticity. So we're going to have a chat system here which provides authenticity, and we learned that our asymmetric tool for doing that is a digital signature. So what do I do? Well, we're going to have our chat system. When A and B are sending messages to each other, it will send a signature over the message, and we'll have our chat client on both B and A verify those signatures, and if it doesn't verify correctly, they're going to say, nope, bad message, and not display it. So, you know, we have our conversation. A asks B, did you order lunch? And, you know, B says, yeah. A asks B, we're a vegetarian? No. Then, you know, much later on, you know, oh, there's this guy at the door to the pair they see. Is that okay? Should I let him in? Well, we have a problem here if we think about what our machine in the middle attacker can do. That, you know, what we would have normally said is that, the machine in the middle attacker, they can't generate signatures because they don't have the private key. But probably the message our machine in the middle attacker wants to send is this one or this one. And we conveniently already have the signature for those. They're right here and right here. And our machine in the middle attacker can just copy those. So they just copy and paste the message with the signature, send it as if it came from B, and there's no way to, you know, sort of figure out what's going on. We just choose a response that we know, like, will work here, and we make that. And this idea is called a replay attack, because we're resending something that was sent earlier. And sort of the key reason why this works is that we forgot to include context in our signature. So we have this way of providing authenticity, but we didn't provide authenticity of the context of the message. That it's important for us to interpret this message correctly, that we know which message it's in reply to. That if it's not in reply to that message, it means something completely different, and the attacker is taking advantage of this. There's questions about this replay attack. So what's a way of solving this attack? So the general thing you'll see systems do to deal with replay attacks is that, well, since we were missing context, we want to add it. And a common form of context to add would be what's called a nonce, or a number used once. And one example would be that we could just have an incrementing counter. And in this case, now, if we want to copy this message here, A's client can say, oh, that number is not one of the numbers I was expecting. I'm going to reject that message. It must be an old message. And because the signature includes the number, the attacker can't edit the 1 to a 54. That's not going to work, because then the signature won't verify anymore. So we've included the extra context that was previously implicit, that this is this far into the conversation. Some questions about our nonce solution here? So there's something that's a little disappointing about this solution, and that's that we have to keep track of extra information in our clients now. That all our clients need to know what's the next number I'm expecting. And if we ever forget that information, we kind of lose, right? That if I ever reset the number back to 1, now the attacker has some old messages that they could potentially sneak in at the appropriate time. So another option is that instead of kind of generating sequential numbers, if we don't want to have to remember numbers, we can generate kind of random numbers that are unique each time because they're big enough random numbers. Here, these numbers probably aren't big enough, but I'm saving space in my slide. And a way we might do this is that we'll have each message contain the number to use for the next message. And then, if we ever reset the numbers, we just get the next, get a new message. We send a number that to them, get a message back, and then we can figure that out again. So that's numbers used once. So I showed you kind of one form of this attack here, where we just substitute an old message. There's another issue with our lack of context here, which is, let's say our chat program supports talking to lots of people, like our attacker M. Well, our attacker M here, they could talk to B. They could get responses from B, and they're going to be signed by B. And with the scheme we've shown so far, if we just make the numbers line up just right, we can just take this message and substitute it here. And even for this kind of alternate scheme, we could have chosen the next number to make that work too. Make that match the number A sent. And the problem here is that we have the context of what message number in the conversation it is, but we don't have the context of who the message is to. So our solution, and generally the solution to these types of problems, is that we need to make sure the signature includes all the information we need to interpret the message. So we can't interpret the message in the wrong way. So a simple idea here would be that we could add to every message who it is for. And in that case, then when we copy the message, A can check, oh, this is a message for M. Why are you sending it to me, and reject it? And so here I'm showing this a case where we have confusion over who's sending it from, because the signature, like, we're using the same public key for talking to everyone. We have this solution of adding our name. Another solution would be that we could use different public keys to talk to different people, but that kind of defeats one of the big advantages we have for public key systems. So you might say, we can't have this problem happen with the symmetric scheme, though. So like the symmetric scheme's safe from it. But it turns out that there's a variant of this with the symmetric scheme called a reflection attack. That's where if A sends to B yes, and then a Mac with a key, I guess I'll say like number one, yes. And then a MAC of that message. So if we're using the symmetric version of signatures, right, our message authentication codes, an attacker who can't generate a new MAC, well, they could take this message and just edit it to make it appear to come from B going to A. And because we forgot to put who the message is for in the MAC, if we're using the same key in both directions, then we have the same type of attack. The attacker has sent a message that wasn't intended by taking an older message and making us take it out of context because we didn't include some necessary context in that message. So questions on this replay attack? Okay, so one thing I want to mention, since it came up in this question in the other section and it's worth talking about, is something you might say in this scheme is, gosh, you know, couldn't we have avoided this issue by, you know, doing encryption and authentication? Like I said, it was silly that we weren't doing in the, you know, quiz question, like clearly that was contrived. And it's true that if we encrypted everything here, so we encrypted and then signed, that would make it hard for our attacker to realize that this message says yes. But in many real scenarios, that's not a real obstacle to an attacker. So in our chat example, it might be the case that like A sends a screenshot of their chat about why they ordered, about what lunch to order to M, or some other party who's not trusted, because it is not a privileged thing. Or in some other scenarios, like let's say we're thinking about like encrypted emails. Well, if I send you an email that requires you to do a specific thing for your job, I might be able to guess the email you'll send next and what's going to be in it. Because, you know, because I sent you an email of something you normally do that I can guess. So in many real practical scenarios, it's not going to be a good idea to assume that the attacker can't guess the contents of some messages. And that's really what we're relying on if we aren't doing one of these sort of number used once style defenses. We're relying that the attacker can't figure out what messages they can take out of context. But we usually want to assume that, well, that sort of information is kind of going to be free. Yes, it's going to make it harder for the attacker if we actually encrypt things, but it's not going to really solve the problem. Okay. And as I mentioned earlier, I think, you know, one of the reasons I'm sort of going over this is that, like, very commonly people will, like, be really concerned, am I using the right encryption algorithm? Am I using the right thing? But, you know, that is sometimes a problem. Yes, you can use an encryption algorithm or a digital signature function that doesn't work, like doesn't provide the security properties it's supposed to provide. But a much more common problem is the sort of misuse like we've seen here, where the functions you're using, the attacker won't bother breaking them because there's a much easier way. And as kind of an example of like the things I would be worried about if I were making encryption software, cryptographic software, I'm gonna give some other examples of some bugs where, you know, there were some pretty big security flaws and it didn't really matter what that they were using a good encryption algorithm and so on. So one example is there was a bug in some implementations of TLS. TLS is the most common way of encrypting traffic to websites. And there were some embedded implementations, at least, that some other implementations that had a bug based on how they implemented the protocol. And we'll talk about TLS in more detail later, but basically, TLS has these two steps. The first step, when we connect to a server, is we verify we're connected to the right server. And once we've done that, we start exchanging encrypted and authenticated messages with that server. Seems great. And some broken TLS implementations had code that basically looked like this. So they, you know, message equals receive it, receive a message, you know, and hey, if the message.type is verify info, do the verify stuff. And if the message.type is sort of receive data info, do the receive data stuff. Seems reasonable, right? We've got a message, we want to process it the right way. And there's this problem here that this sort of if statement setup doesn't check if we skip a step. And that first step is kind of very important. Kind of the whole point of this is that we're not talking to the machine in the middle. But we just skip over this step because we didn't check, you know, when we don't get a, when someone doesn't follow the steps. And the reason the code was written this way is all the test cases, well, the way the protocol works is you have to do the verify stuff before anything else can happen. No servers like skip that step, so they didn't test it. But of course, some malicious actor can make a server that does skip the step. And this if statement says, oh, okay, we're, you know, we just opened the connection, we started setting things up. Oh, we're going to receiving data. Great, okay, let's do that. Let's receive some data. Just skip the verification. So I think, you know, it seems to me it's very understandable how this bug happened, but this is the sort of thing, like, you know, this is a much worse bug than you're ever likely to have from choosing the wrong encryption algorithm. And you need to think about, you know, if you're building cryptographic software, how am I checking for this kind of problem? How am I making sure that there aren't these kind of logic errors that are just going to make it so it doesn't matter what encryption I'm using? You know, they're just going to bypass it entirely. And another example of something of a similar vein is from Matrix. So Matrix is a multi-user distributed chat system, and they wanted to provide end-to-end encryption of multi-user chats. And end-to-end encryption means that if I was chatting to someone, that the message would be encrypted from, say, when it was on my phone until when it was on their phone, so nothing in the middle would have access to the plain text of the message. So to make this happen, we need to somehow get the keys from my phone to their phone. And there's a problem here. How, you know, do we get the keys for my new phone when I change from one phone to the other? And the idea the Matrix people have, which seems very reasonable, is that I'm going to generate a signature saying that, oh, this is the key for my new phone, for my old phone, and if they have the key for my old phone, they can check that. Great. What they actually implemented didn't actually check those signatures. It just trusted, got a list of keys and used them. They just forgot to add the check. So you can just send whatever keys you want. And for our machine in the middle, well, they can just say, yes, they have a new phone. Here's its key. And that would just work. And you can see this is illogical, and it like kind of just completely defeats the point. You know, logic bug, it completely defeats the point of all the cryptography. Doesn't matter how much effort you spent there. And this is, yeah, as I said, what I'd be concerned about if I were implementing a cryptic system is that these kinds of bugs are the first thing I'd be concerned about. Yes, it matters if you choose a stupid encryption algorithm, but this is probably where you're going to get in trouble because you're going to like spend some minimal effort to find a library that, you know, isn't completely out of date. Okay. So we mentioned all these sort of replay attacks and so on. And we're going to have a lab next week, which is basically on doing those sorts of attacks. So in the lab, we're going to have A communicating with B about how much to pay M. And you're playing the role of M, and your job is to demonstrate that you can fool B into paying more than they should. And there's different scenarios, so you might do some replay attacks, you might just generate some new messages because they aren't checking parts of them, but you'll solve the, you know, you'll do these sorts of attacks where we aren't actually breaking the encryption or the authentication. We're just, it just doesn't actually do the right thing. It doesn't actually check what matters. So questions on the upcoming lab? Or anything about our sort of our replay or other protocol attacks, as I'll call them? Okay, so when I introduced public keys, I promised that we'd solve a problem that we didn't solve, which was that, you know, we had a way of, you know, distributing our public keys by broadcasting them, but we still had too many that we want to have, like, our browser connect to a random website and get its public key. And we want to do this without having our browser ship with a million public keys, without having to get a new version of our browser every time there's a new website. So how do we make that work? And kind of the idea we're going to use is that we're going to say, let's say someone else had the public key of a website, something I could do. So let's say, for example, A has the public key of a website. Well, then my browser could talk to A and say website's key. And A could talk back to my browser and say, you know, the website's key is blank, and also have a signature along with that so I can verify that message came from A. So we're going to kind of base it on this idea that, yes, we can't have the public key for every single website in our browser, but we could have the public key of someone who knows the public key of the website. And we're going to do this in a particular way, which is going to be more efficient than my idea of just contacting this person who knows all the public keys. So we're going to say that, you know, A is our authority here that has the public key of B, and C, which is our kind of our browser, wants to learn that public key and knows that A is trustworthy for some reason. That's for some reason we're going to trust A to know the public keys and know the correct public keys, to not lie to us about the public keys. So one thing we could do is we could talk directly to A, but we're going to have this kind of shortcut where instead A is going to generate the message they'd send to us. And what message would they send to us? Well, they'd send that B's public key is this, and they send their signature so we could verify it came from them. And rather than us getting that directly from A, we're going to get that from B. So our browser is going to look up B's address. It's going to contact that address, but not be sure it's actually contacting the real B. But that's fine, because that B is going to reply with this certificate. And since we trust A, which is an assumption, we're going to be able to verify the signature and then verify, therefore, that B's public key is XXX, assuming we trust A to give us that information correctly. So in this scheme, this message here is called a certificate. So this message from A that's signed, so we can verify it really comes from A, is a certificate. And A is known as a certificate authority. And the idea is that if we trust the certificate authority, that message that's forwarded from B is enough to get us B's public key. And notice that when we do this, we don't actually need to talk directly to A at any point in time. We just need A's public key in advance somehow. And how is that going to be practical? Well, we're going to only have a small number of A's so we can ship them all with our browsers, and their keys aren't going to change all the time. So this is how kind of website verification works, that websites go to the certificate authorities with their public key. The certificate authorities, you know, once they get convinced that it's actually the right website, they sign a message saying something like, the public key for foo.com is this. And the websites, when you connect to them and you aren't sure you're connected to the right person, they send back this certificate to let you know, learn their public key, then you use their public key to communicate with them securely. For example, you might use their public key to verify some other messages they send. Now that you know it, because you trust this certificate authority to send it to you correctly, you know, by signing this message. And so, as an example of this, here is a kind of text dump of an old certificate for Canvas. So the actual certificate is in some binary format that's not really readable, but the OpenSSL tool conveniently will dump it out in this sort of kind of readable format. And you can see that here in the certificate, we have a serial number, we have information about how it's signed, we have this issuer, which says the identity of the certificate authority that generated it. So in this case, this is some sort of certificate authority called the Incommon RSA Server CA. We have information about the validity and information about who the certificate is for. Confusingly, the part of this information that matters is this part here. This is what the web browser is going to check. It's going to make sure the subject alternate name for the domain name matches the website you actually tried to contact. If it doesn't, something's wrong, like someone's messed with this Wi-Fi or something like that. And we also have some other information about who the certificate is for here. Now, this is just the message that's saying basically that, you know, it's saying, hey, I'm Incommon, and I'm verifying that Canvas is ITS, that Virginia.edu has a certain public key, but we're missing the public key. We also need a signature, and that's because I didn't show you the whole thing. So later on in the certificate, we're gonna have our public key, and there's actually a whole bunch of other lines here because they're pretty long. And we're gonna have a signature over everything up here, including the issuer plus subject, all the information about who made the certificate and who it's for. All the context, remember we don't want to have this signature taken out of context, so that's how we're gonna avoid it. We have all this information, you know, so we can't interpret it in some other way. And so the idea is that our web browser receives this and it runs our verify function with sort of Incommon's public key and the message, so this whole thing here, and the signature. And it makes sure that equals one. And our web browser, it would seem, needs to have Incommon's public key in advance in order for this to work. And maybe a way we would do that is by shipping it when you download the browser. So questions about our certificate and how it's verified. So this lets our web browser reconnect to canvas.its.virginia.edu for the first time. This lets it learn the public key to use to communicate securely with them and verify that at least someone checked that it was the right public key in some way. Now, something I kind of implied, and that seems like would be the case, is that, oh, so this Incommon server CA, that must be like some very common certificate authority, and therefore every browser would have it. But that's actually not the case. It's actually not in the browser, but yet this still works. So what's going on is, well, that Incommon RSA server CA, well, we don't have its public key yet, so we have to learn it somehow. How do we do that? Well, we need a certificate to tell us that someone we trust has verified this is a real CA you should trust, and this is their public key. And so we're actually going to get a chain of certificates from the web server, letting us go back to one that we actually have shipped with our browser. In the case of Canvas, at the time I made these slides, which you can see was not recently, this was, you know, there was a second certificate signed by the User Trust RSA Certification Authority, and that public key was actually shipped with most OSs or browsers. You might say from these names that, oh, so like there's two different companies involved here, and there's not. They're the same company. There's no company called User Trust anymore. So what we have is this hierarchy of certificates, where some are signed by others, and some of these are trust anchors, meaning that they're included in the browser OS and trusted not only to sign websites, but to indicate, here is another certificate authority you should look at. And you can see that we have some interesting naming here. So you think like you can inspect the certificate and understand what's going on, but like usually there's some background here. So for example, the InCommon RSA Server CA, InCommon is an organ part of Internet 2, which is a nonprofit that UVA subscribes to that runs educational networks in North America. But they don't operate the certificate authority themselves. They contract that out to Sectigo. And User Trust used to be a company, but they haven't been for a long time, since 2004. But certificate authorities last a long time in browser databases. And the name is part of the signature, so you can't change it, or else the signatures become invalid. So the names don't change. So even though it's gone through three different names, it's still labeled in the certificates User Trust RSA Certification Authority. You also might say, like, how do we introduce new certificate authorities? And a common thing that you might have happen there is that, well, you know, we want to introduce one, it's not going to be in every browser or OS yet. So for example, at the time I made this slide, Google was creating a certificate authority, which they called GTS Root R1, Google Trust Services, I guess. And it was included in a lot of browsers and OSs, but not some of them. And so they got GlobalSign to sign a certificate for it to handle the ones it's not included in. And when a web browser receives sort of a list of certificates that includes that, you know, it will stop looking at that list once it finds a key it knows about already. If it doesn't, it just goes up the chain, basically. So questions about our certificate hierarchy? Okay, and so we have a bunch of these trust anchors. I have some old numbers. You can definitely see when I made these slides. Probably these numbers are a little lower now, but they're surprisingly high. So Firefox has 55 distinct entities running certificate authorities. Windows had 86 as of last year. Might be slightly lower now, but there's a lot of them. And when we have a bunch of certificate authorities and signing either more certificate authorities or kind of certificates for actual users like websites or in other contexts, people, we call this a public key infrastructure. So the web public key infrastructure is probably the most well known, but there's a bunch of other ones out there. So there's one that kind of is intended to verify domain name records, for example. I say kind of because it's way less deployed than you'd expect. There's one in most app stores for verifying that the executable programs come from the right place. So the way they'll do that is they'll have a signature over the application. They have to verify that it comes from the right place. They'll have a public key infrastructure where there are certificate authorities and certificates to get the public keys that the individual applications are signed with. Some organizations will do encrypted email, and a common thing for encrypted email or an organization is you have certificates for each person you can send encrypted emails to. And they have some certificate authority, probably in this case run by like a company. So we have a bunch of these PKIs, the web ones most well known, but we all have this idea of having certificate authorities who sign certificates, and maybe there's a chain of certificates, but ultimately it gets us the public keys we actually need to use, which aren't going to be the same for everything. So one sort of obvious question here is, if we have these 55 entities that operate certificate authorities that can sign certificates, how do they verify identity? Why can't I just walk up to Sectigo and say, please give me a certificate for google.com? Like, what's going to stop me from doing that? So has anyone here, does anyone here, because either know what you know the process you've actually gone through to get a certificate, or what you think the process should be? That if you own foo.com, how do you get a certificate for that website? It's an interesting question. So there's a standard for how they should verify it, and I would say it's disappointing. Like, you would expect, oh, they're going to make sure you're the one who paid for the domain, right? That's not what happens. So there's this organization called the CA Browser Forum, which is an organization of a bunch of certificate authorities and pretty much everyone who ships lists of certificate authorities that are trusted, including, you know, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Mozilla, Opera, and a bunch of other companies that you may or may not have heard of. And they decide on a set of rules for what CAs need to do. CAs that don't follow these rules probably aren't going to be included on those lists. And the rules say, provide a bunch of options, but the ones that are used for verifying a domain name like foo.com is that the CA chooses a random value and either looks up the domain contact in the public list of domain contacts and sends that random value to the email address or postal address or phone number in that contact and make sure that you respond with it when you request the certificate, or they go to the website via or check the DNS entries for the website and look for the random value being placed in there in a particular way. So this like handles the issue of like, well, they're not gonna access the website from like insecure Wi-Fi, but it doesn't handle the issue of like, what if you've taken over their server, or what if someone's taken over my foo.com server, or what if someone's convinced routers to have a wrong routing table entry. Well, so it goes to my server instead of the real one. It doesn't like solve those problems directly because they're just, you know, kind of recording that they went to the website most of the time, or the domain name, and it matched at that time with this key. Or they're say sending an email and recording that you received it, but you know, emails, they're probably not sending that email encrypted. So often not sending that encrypted, so that like doesn't necessarily, you know, prevent an eavesdropper from getting the random value. Now, I would say the story about like what certificate authorities do, I would say I find it like remarkable how kind of sort of lax the in-practice procedures are for verifying whether you should get a certificate. And you might say, like, why doesn't that like cause big problems? Hard to say. I guess there are things in practice, like even though the requirements are only doing these, if you're looking for google.com, there's probably some extra steps. They probably have a list of domain names they're gonna like require extra checks. So there's some other things public CAs do that are required by those requirements. And maybe the most notable for making this like, you know, actually kind of secure in practice is that they're required to keep a public log of every single certificate they make. And since this is public, if I say run google.com and I want to know if people are making certificates for google.com that they shouldn't, I can check that public log. And if a certificate authority issues a certificate that's not on the public log, it's structured such that the browsers can check whether the certificate's on the log and reject the connection to the website, say that's not a valid certificate if it's not on the list in the log. So that's probably the most sort of practical way. There's some other things they do. So they support revoking certificates, which seems like a great idea in theory. So when they make a mistake and issue a certificate for google.com, they can revoke it and it should no longer work. Now, a problem you might not have noticed is that when I describe what the browser does when it receives the certificate, I didn't give any steps that checked for revocation. And you'd probably assume that's just because I was omitting steps that real browsers do. But for the most part, I wasn't. That browsers sometimes check for revocation, but not really consistently. The main way that revocation is actually effective is that some browsers will have a list of revoked certificates that they receive with their browser updates. And that at least actually does work pretty consistently. And I guess another thing that CAs do is that since these public keys for the certificate authority are really long-lived, the corresponding private keys, they generally actually keep on sort of specialized hardware that is designed to be hard to remove keys from. Like physically difficult, you'd have to like break things in a way which would be very obvious in order to do that. And most likely, if you don't really know what you're doing, if you try to remove the keys, you'd fail and or delete the keys. So that is some things they do that are kind of good. But that's kind of the reality of how we verify websites today. So questions on certificate authorities, since my next topic is going to be, I'm going to talk about some miscellaneous cryptographic tools, and next time we'll go over talking about how TLS works at a high level. And I need to talk about some additional tools there because TLS uses some tools that we haven't seen. Questions? Certificate authorities. Okay. So, I'm going to talk about three additional cryptographic tools based on to keep it safe with the other lecture, we'll just talk about the first two. And we'll talk about the last one later, so, which is a component of TLS, even though like we don't need it with the tools we have. And these are things that, you know, are kind of not, like we don't need these for confidentiality or authenticity, we have all the tools we need for that, but these are things that are going to come up a bunch and we want you to know about. So the first one is cryptographic hash functions. And to give an example of like where we want one of these, we talked about digital signatures having this function where we can do sign, you know, the public key and the message. And I've kind of acted as if I can put whatever I want in the message. I can have this giant certificate that I, sort of giant certificate data that I sign, you know, where I have like all these names and this giant public key. But many digital signature functions don't actually work that way. And they require you to sign something that's short. But we can handle that by, instead of signing a message, we can sign a secure summary of a message. And our secure summary is going to be produced by a cryptographic hash function. And kind of like a hash function provides a summary of data for like looking up a key in an array, our cryptographic hash function is going to provide a summary, but we are going to need it to be secure. In particular, it would be pretty bad if I use a hash, take a hash of the public key, and an attacker can find a new public key that's their public key that has the same hash. That would be really bad. So our cryptographic hash function is going to be a hash function. We take a hash of some message, get some output, but we want it to be really hard to produce a second message that has the same output. And also, we're going to want it to be, for other purposes, to be irreversible, meaning that if I just have the output, my best way of finding the original message is trying all the possibilities. So a cryptographic hash function will give you this. And these are properties we wouldn't expect from a hash function for like a hash table, because a hash function for a hash table, like, we don't care if someone can do some clever work and find two things that hash to the same thing. We care that the values we put in our hash table won't hash to the same thing most of the time. Like, it's a different problem. And also, like, these functions, to have these properties, are going to have a longer output and also be much slower than, like, a hash function for a hash table will be. And I mentioned sort of one use of this is substituting for messages in the digital signature operation. So we want to sign something, but our sign function has a size limit. This lets us evade that size limit. We just sign the hash. And because it's irreversible and we can't generate new messages with the same hash, that's not going to be something that an attacker can take advantage of, even though we aren't signing the right thing. If we used a non-cryptographic hash, then the attacker might have a way of computing another value that hashes to the same thing. You want to think about how that would work. Like, if our hash function is like add up all the bytes, it's actually fairly easy, right? You just count the difference in the number of bytes and add that byte. There you go. So these are going to have to be computed in a way where there aren't sort of shortcuts like that. Another application of this, especially because of this irreversibility, is that this is one of the ways you can construct message authentication codes. So you talked of message authentication code as keyed hashes. Well, if we have this irreversible hash function, a way we can construct keyed hashes is basically by hashing a key and some data together. And that is most of the way to a message authentication code. So something you might notice I didn't list as an example use that you might be aware is a very common use of secure hash functions is for hashing passwords. So a common scenario we have is that I have like a website where I need to store a bunch of passwords. And I'd really like it to be the case that if someone compromises my website, they don't immediately have everyone's passwords. And why would that be? Well, one big reason is that often people use the same passwords on website A as website B. We'd really like website B not to be completely compromised when website A is compromised. We'd also like it to be the case that, you know, maybe, you know, if we recover from this, you don't have to have everyone change all their passwords right away. And using a cryptographic hash, you know, seems to help with this because, well, they can't reverse it. If they could reverse the hash, you know, they might as well just guess all the passwords. So it seems like it solves that problem. But the hash functions you want to use for storing passwords are not your general cryptographic hash functions. Because even though the cryptographic hash is irreversible, in the sense that they have to try all the possibilities, it's not practically irreversible because the cryptographic hash you're going to look up for doing something like making digital signatures or message authentication codes is going to be as fast as it can be. And that's not what we want for password storage. Because as fast as it can be means you can guess passwords really fast. And the problem is that there's, you know, if we can guess a quadrillion passwords, we can often find people's passwords. People are not that good at choosing passwords. And with a very fast cryptographic hash function and like a cluster of machines with GPUs, that's probably not hard to do. So there are these special cryptographic hash functions that are generally built atop the faster ones, which are designed specifically to be slow and resource intensive, where the idea is that when an attacker gets our list of hash passwords that not only do they have to guess each one password to check it, each of those guesses takes a bunch of time, so they can't try a quadrillion possibilities even with their bunch of GPUs. They're going to have to go much slower than that. Questions? Our cryptographic hashes and password hashing idea. Okay. So one other thing we mentioned here is that we want to talk about secure random numbers. So far we've been kind of making these assumptions that we just generate a key and like a shared secret, or generate a public and private key. But to do that, we need some way of having values no one else knows. And we'll often call this a random number. In the case of this cryptography, we want to secure a random number. So this means, you know, that we need a number that people don't know. That's what we mean by random. It's hard for people to know. So this means that some common ways of generating random numbers that are fine for other ideas about random numbers, like doing a simulation, are not good. So like something you might have seen is like you could generate random numbers with, you know, by calling sRand and then rand in C. And, you know, maybe you call sRand with the current time. This is not going to solve our unpredictability problem. Yeah, it generates random numbers that are fine for like your game or your simulation a lot of the time, but we have a couple problems here. So one problem here is that the time is pretty predictable, and it's still pretty predictable even if we have it like down to the microsecond. There's not that many possibilities that are likely, you know, for someone who's trying to like guess these numbers. Like they probably have some bounds on what that time is, and they can try a lot of things and get, you know, eventually get it. We don't want that to be possible. Another problem is that if you know sRand and C, I don't know what random functions people have used, or maybe and some similar functions in other languages for not secure random numbers, this argument here is 32 bits. There's only 4 billion 32-bit numbers. You can try a lot of them. So this really doesn't work. And there's actually going to be some other properties we want where this also is going to be a problem for our goal, which is, you know, that it's hard to predict. So we want it not to be predictable. We also want it to be the case that if they know some earlier numbers, it doesn't help them guess later numbers. And this is not the way that sort of general random number tools for like writing games or writing simulations work. They generally don't care about this property because it takes extra work and extra time to provide it. And so there it's, if you know how the random number generator works, you know a bunch of random numbers, you can actually compute the next one. And we don't want this to be true for what we call cryptographically secure numbers. The numbers we want to use to generate keys that if someone guesses, we lose all our confidentiality and authenticity properties. We just don't have that. It's not secret anymore. We aren't verifying who it comes from anymore. Another property we'll often want is we'll want it to be the case that if I generated some random numbers in the past, and then I compromise the machine later, that I can't just back compute what those old numbers were. So we'll want this to be sort of a one-way computation in some way. So we don't sort of unnecessarily leak old keys when there's no reason for that to happen. So questions about our random number requirements. So a question might be, how can we generate random numbers? How can we get numbers with these properties? What should we do? Yeah?
Just ask them, like, move their mouse around randomly.
So we went to, so you're saying ask to move the routes randomly. So your idea is that we want to get information from the environment that hopefully an attacker doesn't know. And this is in fact the kind of, so you probably see some programs that like ask to move the mouse, but more generally, like the typical way we'll solve this problem is we'll have the OS gather information from the machine's environment to let us get information the attacker shouldn't know that is actually, you know, hopefully for all practical purposes, unpredictable. And yeah, after syncing with the other lecture, I will probably finish up here since we'll do this next time. But basically what sort of Linux does, so Linux has a special file called devu-random. If you open that file and read from it, it will give you pseudo random bytes. And where those bytes come from ultimately is that they're seeded, like we need an original source to like make sure that they're not predictable. And the not predictable part is that we collect things like the exact timing of I/O events, like the exact timing of when I press keys and when I move the mouse and when the packets came in off the network and off the Wi-Fi, like all these sort of information that should be very hard for an attacker to know all of. And also, on most modern processors, we actually have some dedicated hardware that has a unstable circuit, a deliberately unstable circuit for producing kind of values that are random because it's like electrically unstable that are mixed into that. And basically, the OS collects this information and does some processing on it. We'll talk like at a high level outline of what that processing might look like to produce random numbers for things like generating keys for symmetric encryption. And that's where I'll finish up today. Next time we'll finish up talking about this and talk about kind of an outline of what TLS actually does, including talking about key exchange, which is an extra tool TLS uses we haven't talked about.